So from here on, I have to be clean.
Well, you just have to put this in your pocket for something. One more thing. We may take a break halfway through the class. Professor Rackley had heart surgery not that long ago, and they were out of energy about halfway through. I don't think this is going to be a full 2-hour class anyway, so we may end up taking a break and then we'll come back after 5 or 10
minutes. Anyhow, nice to meet all of you. And I wanted you to know that to manage an architecture office, it's no mystery. It's no different, basically, than you manage your household. Money comes in, there are expenses. If there is more money comes in than there are expenses, you are ahead of the game. That's all. You know, I could leave. But let's take a small office. That was the size of my office. You have to know, first of all, your expenses and your payroll, including your principal, your associates, adds up, say in this case, $445,000, but you have to add, always, don't forget, unless goddamn Republicans will kill it, the Social Security, you know, that is one of the sacred foundations of modern America. You have to pay, it's called FICA, the Social Security, and you have to pay insurance. You don't, it's not a law, but if you are an employer with any conscience, you want to have all your employees be insured. Okay? So, it in my office came to $650,000. I had 8 people. 8 times 2,080, that's the number of hours a year. That came to 16,000 some hours. So you divide the total expense by 16,640, about $40 an hour, okay? That's what, to run the office. But that's not all. These are only salaries. In addition to that, you have a huge amount of overhead. You will hear that word overhead. That's not an overhead projector. That's the overhead is a serious expense. There is a secretary, receptionist. Now, why aren't they on the payroll? Because they don't produce drawings. They're none. Architecture production people are an overhead. You have rent, you have professional liability insurance, which you will hear from Mr. Friedlander how important it is to have liability insurance. I don't necessarily agree. If you want to save a lot of money, put everything you own in your, if you're married, that is, put it in your spouse's name. Your house, your car, everything, and be faithful, okay? Then you don't need liability insurance. Anyhow, automobile, printing, telephone, utilities, legal expenses, which are amazing, I'm telling it in front of him, amazingly small part of our expenditure. Our biggest one is insurance, always, and rent. So the total of overhead items divided by the number of hours is about $61 an hour. Okay? So $61 an hour, and, no, I'm sorry, it's $39. $22 an hour. Add the two together, you are about 61. But you haven't made any profit. You have to add profit. And I tell you, when you calculate in architecture, you're dreaming, but you have to. You should add always 20% for profit. You will never make it. I know the Chicago firms, I toward the end of my career, I was a partner in a large firm. If they made 10%, it was huge. Our average profit was 8% a year. You know, it was OWPNP. But you start with 20. You know, you start with a hope. So it adds up to $75 an hour. Okay? Now, what kind of fees do you need to have to sustain this office? And you can look at this later when you have a handout. I just briefly go through it. You know, we went through production costs, $650,000, overhead, $370,000. We had over $1 million divided by 12 months. That's $85,000 a month. Add to it profit, that's $102,000 a month. That's a, excuse me, shit pot full of money to collect. That's not all, because that's, in addition to that, that's your architect. You have consultants. When you do a building, especially a size, not a house, but a sizable building, school, hospital, a third of your fee goes to your consultants. About 12% to the structural, and about 22% to the mechanical. These are important numbers. A third of your fee will go to the consultants. And never, never forget in calculating your consultants. Many architects, I had a partner, nameless, who always said, gee, we collected $100,000. We are doing well. Are we were not doing that well because we only collected, you know, $65,000 or whatever, because the rest went to the consultants. Now, many architects used to play a dirty game, sat on the consultants' money, and used it for weeks and weeks. Because when we collect, the consultant didn't know that. So we really used their money. And never my friend. I had one philosophy, one instruction to my secretary. The day we collect, within 24 hours, we issue a check, whether it's to the structural, to the mechanical, interior designer, whatever consultants we have. Because of that, we have a fantastic relation with our consultants. I used to tell them, when I get paid, next day you get paid. If I get screwed over and don't get paid, you don't get paid either. It's the deal. And both the mechanical and the structure accepted and loved it. You can break it down further if you're a neurotic bastard. You know, what do you have to collect a month, a year, and every day? You used to have, when I was a partner in OWPNP, the general manager went like this around. He said, oh my God, I should have gotten $8,000 today. I didn't get a penny. What am I going, you know? You can't do that. You don't break it down per day. But it's very important to know. Okay, the next thing, not just how much you get, but when you get it. You know it by now. If you don't, well, you most of them worked in offices. Raise your hand if you have not worked in. You are the only virgin, huh? Anyhow, if you work in offices, you know that the work consists of phases. Schematic design, design development, construction documents or working drawings, bidding and the negotiations, and construction. I put down there the percentage of generally known jobs, and you have to take the total fee and break it down to each of the phases. Because let's assume you get a job and you have a good fee. You start working and you don't know and aren't aware what each phase is. So you finish design and you go into working drawings and you haven't been paid. Drastic mistake. Clients are going to try to take advantage of you. Not all, but certainly developer clients. Developers are an interesting breed. I always had a love and hate relation with them. I loved them because I got a lot of work from them. I hated them because they tried to take advantage of me. Eventually I learned not to allow that to happen. It's very important to make sure that in each phase you get paid before you heavily enter into the next phase. So you are paid by the developer for design development, design development, or the design, whatever you call it, before you start working drawings. If you just are a nice person and trust him and go into working drawings, you can be murdered financially. You have very little hold over your clients. Architecture is really a very difficult profession. It's too late to tell you. But it's a fun profession if you can do it well. There is one way to be paid for the design, the agreed on amount, by not starting working drawings. Okay? That is one crucial phase in architecture, you know?
There's another critical sign too. It's usually around the time of civil or permit, when you're in the CD phase and you're 80-90% through and up to doing permit civils, because the developers are always anxious to get that process started as soon as possible. You have a lot of leverage at that point, and it makes a lot of sense to insist on being made current financially before handing over the permit drawings for the owner to submit.
Absolutely. And what simply up to here, the way I would conclude that every time you're opening an office, if you are on your own, if you work for somebody else, this lecture is important, but not as vital as when you have your own operation. Make a chart. The chart is a simple thing. So much money comes in, and mark it in the time scale for 6 months ahead. I always had in my office 1 year ahead projection, but the critical is 6 months. And what money comes in and when comes in. And be a realist. On the end of the design phase, don't put in the amount of money you are going to get. You know goddamn well that the client is going to be 2 months delayed. So if you finish the drawings the 1st of April, it will be the 1st of July, or whenever, and you get the money. It's very difficult. How do you survive when you are a small office? By taking out a loan. And my recommendation is to take out a loan often from the bank. Banks are stupid, crazy bastards. I cannot tell you I tell you my experience. I was in business, started my business in 1956. And in 1989, I ran into trouble. Until then, I never borrowed a penny. My business account was at First Chicago. My private checking account was First Chicago. Neither one earned any interest. They made money on it. I really needed money. I ran into trouble in 1989.
Which was a major slowdown in our business.
Yeah,
yeah,
89, it was a big slowdown. And I had contracts with the city of Chicago, who had very slow payer, and various other contracts, so I was covered, but I didn't have the cash. So I called the bank, I said, I need $100,000. He says, what collateral can you offer? I said, if I had the collateral, I wouldn't call you. So the banker says, well, we have no record of your financial, I don't know, acuity or whatever. I said, you're out of your goddamn mind. I've been in business almost 30 years. I never borrowed money. That is the best evidence that I am a goddamn great manager. He says, not from our point of view. Why you should borrow? I said, I should borrow so that you guys make money? He says, yes. I am a vulgar guy, so I told him, go fuck yourself. I took my money and called my friend Michael Gellick, Professor Gellick here, and he says, he banks at the LaSalle. He's sure I get a loan. Went over to the LaSalle bank that afternoon, got $100,000. Also, next day, I got a call from a vice president from First Chicago. Mr. Maxey, you closed your accounts. I said, yes, because you, whoever it was, the stupid man who talked to me, implied that I'm not a good manager. Well, to cut a long story short, the banks don't change their policy so fast. So borrow periodically and pay it back.
You know, that's good advice, but Professor Maxey did have collateral to offer. What do you think the collateral was?
Me.
Well, that's close. It was the accounts receivable. He had a right to collect a large amount of money from the city and other clients. It just was in the future.
Delayed.
But that is very good collateral to borrow against. In fact, it's the rough reason for borrowing, which is to smooth out the bumps and valleys in the financial collections that you get from your clients. So if you had told the bank about the receivables, I bet First Chicago would have loaned you.
Well, I felt so insulted by being told that I'm not a good manager that I got a little vulgar. This is not so bad. It's good for the soul. Anyhow, now, what fee to charge? That is page 4. That is a very difficult thing. There are bandied around numbers in the profession that in an apartment building you should get 5%, in a hotel you should get 7%. This might be true, but there is only one way to test it, is to put down, by trial and error, say you have a $12 million apartment building, and you say, the absolute minimum, I can take this job at 4%. Well, can you? You start writing, 4% is $480,000. Who do I have to pay out? The structural engineer? My mechanical engineer, a little bit to the spec writer because I don't write my own specs. coordinating the engineers, that costs you money, and put in 20% profit. You will not make it, but start out. That comes to 3,344 hours. Is that enough? And then you start putting the schematic design, design development. This is based on your last job, your experience. And if you don't have experience, you can always call me. I help you. Really. If you get a big job and you don't know how to charge fee, I'm a free advisor. Anyhow, it turns out to be that 4% is not enough. You are short of hours. So what can you do? You can increase the fee to 6%. Well, I don't know your client. He's going to balk and cry like stuck pig, but somewhere there is a fee which is fair, which is over 4%. So increase it to 6%. If you do that, then, by the way, the numbers are incorrect down there. 6% fee is for 720,000, that's correct. The structural engineer, 12.5%, should be 90,000. The rest of the figures are by and large correct. Turns out to be that it will give you 4,666 hours, which is just about enough. Okay, 6%. Now, if the client wants to bargain, what do you do? Well, if he is a good client, a reliable client, who is likely to give you more work, and if you are hungry, you know what hungry is? That you have an office of 6 people, and you have to try to maintain it, and maybe you don't make a lot of profit on this job. I mean, it's a judgment call. Instead of 6%, try. Start at 5.75. And the client might go along with it. You never can tell. Anyhow, why don't we take any questions, by the way? Any questions?
Professor Max, I said, don't sweat the numbers here. So it's not going to be critical to be able to do this kind of calculation or anything like that. But what's important is the philosophy, understanding how you need to calculate your fees by figuring out what it's going to take you to do a particular job, how you organize your cash flow by understanding when you're going to be billing, how much, and how much longer it will take to get paid. There's a lot more involved in running an architectural business than the design that you're taught primarily in this school. So right now it's about 10:30. Why don't we plan on coming back in about 10 minutes, and we'll resume with the rest of the professor.
Unfortunately, little bit, Professor Friedlander is wrong. This you cannot learn. You either got it or you don't. It is, I had a textbook when I went to School of Architecture. I went to Miami of Ohio. I never forget the textbook. The title of the textbook was, I can't get hold of it anywhere, never seen it. Never refuse a conversation with a reputable stranger. And that's where it is. You never can tell where the next job comes from. Why do people hire you as an architect? Because they know you, or they know your work, or you were recommended by somebody. Consequently, the more people you know, forget, you don't have any work yet. There is no way to be recommended. But the more people you know, and not just know by name, but socially, engage with them, meet them, the more people you know who know Jim Jones, who's an architect, and people, and if you start to go around, when your circle of acquaintances is wide enough, that some of them will need an architect and might call you, might. The other important thing is to belong to organizations. I don't care what they are, the Boy Scouts or the Communist Party. They all, okay. I mean, you will meet somebody who might need an architect. And be written up. Now, how do you get written up? You heard the name Stanley Tigerman, the architect, used to be a professor here. When Stanley started his office, he had very few jobs, maybe two or three little jobs. He hired the best delineator to do beautiful ink drawings of those buildings. So he had a brochure already. None of them were built, but he had a brochure. And take any job at the beginning. You know, it doesn't matter what it is. You should enter all competitions. That's expensive, but increase your social network, okay? Whether you are teaching, whether you get active in the AIA, you go to lectures. If you have an opportunity, you write an article, letter to the editor, be known, okay? I mean, there are ways to be known. There's an architect in Chicago, I forgot his name. He was a very rich architect. He's an older man. Yes, Dick Berensick. Dick Berensick, it used to be Berensick and Conti. Dick Berensick became known. He made the front page of the Daily News, used to be a Chicago paper. By what? By beating up his mother-in-law. That's... Anyhow, so there are a variety of ways. Whatever level you have, get it publicized. Stanley used to go, Stanley Tigerman, with these ink drawings twice a year. Went to New York and visited every editor, Architecture Record, Forum, Progressive Architecture, whatever magazines were at that time. And took out one of the editors for lunch and showed him his exciting work. The work was not exciting, but it was beautifully drawn. just phenomenally beautiful. And eventually, people know about Stanley. And, you know, that's what it's all about. And, you know, there is a difference, let's show some people, between marketing and selling. Selling is when you have the job already and you present it to the client and want the client to accept it, okay? You have to have beautiful presentation drawing, you have to have good verbalization. You're selling the client. I never forget the best selling job in my life. The job didn't get built. And that's not here or there. In Oak Park, downtown, was supposed to be a high rise. And a client came to me, would I be the associate architect? He already had a young architect. And we joined forces, and Oak Park was up in arms against the high rise. And I had to present it. And I listened to the commissioners, and I realized that I'm going to lose. How can I win this project? I spent a weekend thinking about it. And then it occurred to me that the head of the commission, of the building, I don't remember the name of the commission, older man, he was passionate traveler in Europe, all over. And I traveled a lot around in Europe. So I figured, I'm not going to show a building design. I'm going to show him slides from Europe with a narrative. And I started out that I want you to use your imagination. You conjure up the building. I don't have a building yet. But I want to have the feeling, the foreground, and I show the foreground something in Versailles or in Vienna, wherever. And then I said, I want the charming feeling in the little plaza, the short cafes from Paris. And I, all through the thing, I showed other buildings. Nothing, I had no design. And he loved it. He absolutely loved it. And he pushed it through. They approved the goddamn building. I mean, it was my most memorable victory without any drawing to sell a building. It was a memorable building evening anyhow, because at the end, the head of the building commission, not the committee, said it was 1 o'clock in the morning, 1:30. Anybody, any other question? And he said, could I get a note to my wife that I was here till 1:30? Anyhow, the building never got built. You know why? Long story. Ultimately, because Oak Parkers are very strong people, they didn't want the high rise. So they figured out that the high rise will cast a shadow after 4 o'clock in the summer, 4 to 7, on Frank Lloyd Wright's Unity Temple. And that killed the building. You never can tell how do you win and how do you lose. Anyhow, that's selling. When you sell a project, you should sell it before you show any drawing. That's my conviction. You whatever you do, politics, bullshit, but you gain the attention of your audience you go in and you show the big panel, you lost the game. You have to get your audience on your side before you lift the cover sheet. Give you another example. Not totally honest, but you're never totally honest when you sell. Okay? We did the Lake Forest Place, one of the largest elderly projects in Illinois for Presbyterian homes in Lake Forest. And Lake Forest is an absolute mother to build anything modern. You cannot. I mean, those people are hell-bent against modern. So I knew it's going to be a traditional design. I have nothing against traditional architecture if it's done honestly and not, bullshit mixture of styles. But you decide on a style and you do it to the best of your ability. But still, how do you sell it to them? I mean, so this is what I did. We made a preliminary design, and we had a certain kind of gable roof. Then I went around the city of Lake Forest trying to find a house with that kind of roof, slide. And then we had certain kind of windowsill, and I drove around with my partner, Al Hidvig, to find two or three buildings with similar sills. And all the components of the building I found example of in Lake Forest. So in the presentation, before unveiling the boards, I showed the slides. I said, our building is going to replicate what you have in Lake Forest. The fact that they had only one building like that doesn't matter. They don't remember. They visual memory is zilch. Anyhow, they approved the building, the one of the largest buildings, the first presentation, and they loved it. When we showed the elevation, they loved it, except the entrance they felt wasn't, whatever it was, wasn't imposing enough. So I said, I will be happy to bring in revised drawings, and then you can reconsider the building. Oh, Mr. Metzler, we'll approve it tonight. We'll trust you to bring in a revised thing. So, I mean, they were eating from my hands. You can do that if you do the intelligent selling job. But that's selling. Marketing is probably even more difficult because you start from nothing. But as I told you before, you get known, you will be able to do the marketing. Everybody can do marketing. If you cannot do any marketing, you shouldn't be in architecture. Or be satisfied by, working for somebody else. There's nothing dishonorable about that. Let's assume you get the job. That's it. You got the job. What fee to charge? And what kind of how to get the client to agree to it? Well, figuring the fee. The fee can be figured several ways. One, it could be the basis of construction cost. So if the building is more expensive, you get more money. The clients don't like that. I don't blame them on an apartment building because they need to. Next time I come and see you, we are going to talk about the pro forma. On an apartment building pro forma, you have to plug in the expenses. You can't plug in a percentage. That's bullshit. You have to have a figure. If the client needs a figure from you, you should know enough about apartment buildings to give it. But make sure that the scope of the building is defined. Because when they add the swimming pool on the top floor, you get screwed. Because that's a lot of extra work. Or when they add this or that. If you can define the building tightly, in descriptive manner, then you covered your ass. Okay? If you get a lump sum fee, you better know your business. How do you handle if the scope is changed? You covered it by a note. What happens with inflation? You know, let's assume you got a lump sum, and there are changes, and what you thought you paid the hourly rate is gone up. So the more you can define, the happier you are. We'll talk about that in a minute. The other would be, if we live in an ideal world, that you get paid on an hourly basis, but that's invitation for robbery. Because down at our heart, we are all thieves. I mean, maybe not you, but I am. If that, not thieves, if they pay me on an hourly basis, I won't watch my hours. I work on it, and revise it, and you know, delicately work on it. That's totally unrealistic. I don't think there are any buildings nowadays which are given that way. There are some moon multipliers. You know, one is that you charge 2.5 times payroll. You assume, and that's generally true, that 40% of your cost is labor, 40% is overhead, and 20% profit. Except, there are some tricks to that. I don't like multipliers. The payroll should include the benefits. What it includes. And the multiplier is different between a small office and a large office. I prefer lump sum fee and I caution, and that's from the next page, other issues which you need to settle. You need to settle what is included in your fee. You need to settle when do you get paid. What happens with the reimbursables, which is printing and other odds and ends? What is the scope of the job? And in special cases, limit field visits. All of this could be settled in a letter. Now, lawyers disagree sometimes, not intelligent lawyers. They would like to have an AIA contract where everything is defined, and most clients will, when you start them, get a job, and you bring in an AIA contract, they will tell you. They don't want to hire an attorney. Pay an attorney to read it. I mean, it's crazy. Just write me a letter. And that letter you write is going to be the contract, because he'll countersign it. And the letter, intelligent attorneys, I mean, attorneys who are experienced in construction litigation, will agree that you can have a letter contract as long as you define everything. What is the fee, what is based on, how changes are handled, at what's the time limit, etc. Maybe, probably you can do it on one page. I've done a lot of jobs with a one-page contract. I never done a job without any agreement. You have to have an agreement. There is no question. And the last and most important thing, if you have a relation to your client, the relation to your engineers has to be based on the same agreement. Okay? You cannot have an agreement with the client on percentage basis and a different one with your engineers. It's very important that you have an agreement with your engineer before you enter into an agreement with your client. What do they include in their fee? Field visits. You know, you have to include certain amount of field visits, and let's assume you included once a week inspection. How about your engineer? Does he have to be there once a week? No. Does he have to be there at all? Yes. So they have to be there at certain times. Structure engineer at certain ports, check the reinforcing. But how do they get paid? What rate, what is their fee, a percentage, and a clear agreement when they get paid, that they get paid when you get paid. And enter into, if you have a contract, have identical contract with your engineers. Lastly, make sure that the engineer is covered with adequate insurance, because it's an impossible situation. You will have to, if he didn't have any insurance, and it was a structural engineer's fault, you are going to, if there is a lawsuit, you are going to carry the bag. There is no question. You are responsible for it. He's under your contract. And lastly, no verbal agreement. Verbal agreement is bullshit. Put it in writing. So if you drop dead tomorrow, your partner or your wife has a document. Okay? I'm done. Any questions?
But the 15, 20, 40, 5, and 20 general numbers have been around for a very long time. What Professor Maxey is saying is that they may vary job to job, and it's important for you to understand the production process so that you plan for it properly, but the norms really haven't changed ever. I can give that an answer if you want. If your form of payment is a percentage of the total construction cost, but the building never gets built, the basis for calculating the percentage is the last estimated cost of construction, or perhaps what the budget that you were designing to was.
Okay.
If the scope of the project changes, where construction becomes more expensive, hooray for you, because your fee is usually a percentage of the actual construction cost. But here's the caveat. you will have clients who will ask you to convert your fee from a percentage basis to a lump sum once there's an actual construction contract and the cost of the work is known. You just have to be careful that if there is a change in the scope of construction, that that also gets recognized by a change in the agreement for your fee. There's another reason that lawyers tend to charge on an hourly rate and architects don't, and that is because architects have more control over the ultimate work and work product that they do than a lawyer does. Not complete control, because things can get out of their hands, but in general, once you understand the scope of a project, you can do a reasonably good job of predicting what you're going to need to spend in-house, whereas a lawyer has to cope with things that other people are doing. We might have a very simple and short lawsuit, or the other side can make it incredibly expensive. So much of the scope of what we do is out of our control. That's why lawyers traditionally tend to charge hourly. Before we end, I just want to... let me finish up just by amplifying on some of the topics that John covered, because there are some other suggestions you probably should know about. One of his suggestions about marketing was to get yourself as active and involved as you can with as many people and as many settings, doing as many things as you can. There's one marketing device in particular that I've seen as being unusually effective, especially for people like you going out on your own, starting your own firms, where you're probably going to be taking single-family residential work to start with, and that is to work through the public library system in the city and the suburbs. They all have programs where they sponsor speakers to come in the evening and talk for a half hour or an hour and put on a slideshow of educational interest to the community. Well, the community is fascinated by architecture because they don't really understand it. And if you can put together a program on how to do a remodeling without any hassle, or just teaching them the difference between Victorian and Georgian architecture and putting yourself out there as somebody who knows what they're doing, you will be amazed at the number of contacts you have for people who just view you as their source of architectural knowledge. And when they do have a project, or when their neighbor has one and they're talking together, your name is likely to come up. So I have found that a lot of my clients operating small firms have had tremendous success in generating business through use of the library system. Professor Max, I also talked about selling, and he distinguished it from marketing. He used the example of selling to a commission, and that's certainly a valid kind of sale. But selling is a one-on-one kind of activity. Marketing is you to the world without any necessarily specific individual targets. It's just to a general audience. Salesmanship or selling is when you work one-on-one to try to persuade somebody to do what you want. In Professor Maxey's case, it was voting to permit a project. But it might just as easily be persuading a client to hire you rather than somebody else. You will have beauty contests that you'll end up participating in, where a client will call in two or three or even more architectural firms to interview, essentially, with the idea of choosing one to do that client's project. Well, selling is all about understanding the situation from the viewpoint of your client or of the person you're communicating with, stepping into his or her shoes and figuring out how they view the world. Professor Max, I gave examples of commissioners on planning commissions who had biases, either in favor of European architecture or Lake Forest architecture, whatever it might be. The smartest thing for you to do when selling is to get out of your shoes and figure out what the world looks like from the standpoint of whoever you're trying to sell to. It doesn't mean that it's right. It means that if you can appreciate what they appreciate, you'll be much more effective in communicating. So if you're trying to sell a project in a beauty contest to a potential client, research the client first. Find out what you can about that person, either from other projects or maybe by talking to the person, him or herself. Before you go in for the beauty contest, you may contact them on the telephone.
This is true about all disagreements. I find that My disagreements with my wife.
Now, this isn't rocket science, and it's not some brilliant insight of mine. It's pretty well understood aspect of sales and negotiation. There's a terrific book called Getting to Yes, which is just a little tiny paperback. If you're ever interested in understanding how to negotiate with people, it's the fastest, best read. I'm involved in it because the writers of it were my professors in law school. They taught a workshop called Negotiation Workshop, and really our assignment at the end of the class was to proofread their galleys for their book and to add anything we thought was appropriate, which seems to be a conflict of interest. But in any event, we did it, and the book is remarkably good. But the lesson is key. There is nothing wrong with doing some intelligence gathering work before you go into your meeting, even if it means talking to your client before the meeting to get a sense of what they're looking for. Most potential clients are thrilled to be contacted and to be debriefed so that they can understand, they can just ventilate what their thoughts are and give you a sense of what's going on. Now, there's no guarantee to win these beauty contests, but in general, if you can and appreciate however your client or the other person is seeing things, it will help you tremendously. Professor Maxey also talked about your payroll and figuring out how to charge hourly rates based on what you or your employees are earning. That is a well-established approach, and in fact, it's in the AIA documents, in a sense. They have a term in those AIA documents, especially the B101, called direct personnel expense, which they abbreviated DPE for direct personnel expense. And it basically is figuring out what an employee costs the firm, the salary they're paid, the benefits that they earn, all the different costs that accumulate with that person. And then to bill out that person's hourly rate at a multiple, more than the DPE. Typical is a multiple like 2.5. So if it costs $100 an hour for an employee, then you would bill out that employee's time at $250 an hour, just to use round numbers. It usually costs about half that much or less for an architectural employee, which gives you a sense of how much you're actually earning in these architectural jobs. And finally, Professor Maxey talked about your contracts with your sub-consultants. It is a critical element of running an architecture firm. Professor Maxey can talk to the importance of establishing relationships with the sub-consultants. And that's absolutely true, because you're going to go through high times and low times. You're going to have extra benefits, and you're also going to get screwed sometimes by your own clients. And it's important to have relationships with sub-consulting engineers so that they know that they're in the same game that you are, that what happens to you happens to them. That's why Professor Maxey is so fast to pay them, so that they understand that you're in the same boat together. That means that if the owner has a beef, a problem, with some aspect of the design, you and the engineer may share whatever the consequences are. If they withhold $1,000 of fees, you may agree to absorb $750 of it, and the engineer absorbs $250 of it. It also allows you to postpone paying them until you've actually been paid yourself. There is a legal technique for doing this in a way that makes it enforceable. And that's called flow-down subcontracting. Flow-down subcontracting. General contractors do it with all their subcontractors. And what it generally means is the following. That you take your contract with your client and you incorporate all of the business terms into your subcontract with the subconsultant. Often you do it by stapling your contract to a purchase order to that engineer, or something equivalent. But the idea is that whatever legal rules and agreements bind you to your client also bind the engineer to you identically. That makes you kind of transparent where engineering issues are concerned. Yes, you are liable to the client for mistakes made by your engineer, but because you have the same terms and conditions, your engineer is liable to you for the same amount that you're liable to the client. And if there are issues of document ownership, who owns the copyright, like we talked about last week, You want to make sure that the same terms are in your agreement with your engineers as the owner has in his agreement with you. If you're giving up copyright ownership to the client, you better darn well be receiving copyright ownership from the engineer so that you have it to give up to the client. The idea is to be parallel between the two contracts. And it's relatively easy to do once you think of it that way, and that way you can use your contract to spot all the issues with your sub-consultants. John, anything to add to any of that?
No, thank you for your attention.
Thank you, and we have the midterm next week. It's going to be a straightforward midterm. It's all multiple choice. You are welcome and encouraged to bring in all your notes. Definitely bring your B101 contract. There are a number of questions on that contract. It's strictly open notes. It usually takes an hour to an hour and a half, but I'll be here the full 2 hours if it takes that long. And then a week from, I guess, the Monday after next Wednesday, so a week from Monday evening, I hope you'll all show up to my firm. We have the pizza party on my 66th floor, the Sears Tower. Architecture from 66 stories up is very different than it is from the ground level. We'll have a good time with the pizza party and looking at the architecture through all the windows from all four sides, and we'll also go over the answers to the midterm quickly so you know how you did and what was right and what was wrong. Don't sweat the midterm. In the history of this class, which goes back a long time, to 1985, I think, no one has ever gotten a perfect paper on it. It's difficult, I mean, just because this isn't what you're used to learning. So don't be too scared if you miss some questions. My goal is to make sure that whatever grade you get in this class doesn't hurt your academic or future career. So it's kind of curved generously, and anyone who really screws it up should see me afterwards, and we'll figure out how to do something about it. All multiple choice. I'll provide an answer sheet, and you're just circling the letters. There will be roughly 40 questions or so. So I'll see you next week, and then the Monday after that.